Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 29th of April, 2024. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. Here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. Students gain experience. Bettendorf program gives jumpstart to health care career. Eva Lopez wants to go into the medical field but does not want to give up on her involvement with sports. A program Bettendorf High School has let her start exploring and find a field that lets her combine them. Athletic training. Lopez, a junior, said, "I don't want to give up sports because it's been a main part of my entire life. I realize I could be an athletic trainer, mixing sports and the medical field." The health science program at Bettendorf High School allows students like Lopez to dip their feet into a variety of healthcare professions and even get a jump start on professional certifications. The curriculum includes hands-on labs, lectures, clinical opportunities, field trips, and class visits from a variety of local healthcare professionals. Bettendorf students can become a certified nursing assistant, known as a CNA, before graduating high school, along with earning other dual credit healthcare courses via Eastern Iowa Community Colleges. Thanks to a partnership with Medic, EMS, Bettendorf is also one of the first high schools in the state to offer EMT certification courses as well. Both programs prepare students to take the state certification exam, which let them go straight into those roles after high school. Like Lopez, though, not all students in the program have their sights set on nursing or emergency response. The chance to try different courses and start learning and narrowing career plans can help them prepare for after they graduate. Another junior, Chloe Zadega, said, "I'm looking at becoming a pediatric nurse practitioner. I thought it was a great opportunity because, number one, it's free, and number two, it kind of gives me an idea if this is really what I want to do. So it definitely helps with future planning." Bettendorf's program does not just focus on the hard scientists. Students also get a glimpse at the business end of the medical field. Pardon me while I find my page here. There it is. We learned a lot about insurance, which I had no clue about, Lopez said. "I like that I got that knowledge, so when I get a job, I'll know what coverage option is best for me." Teaching students about general business and life skills is also a focus for the program, said Roxanne Schumerman, a BHS health science teacher. She and Dr. Anna Roeder led Bettendorf's health sciences program. Schumerman said, "We feel pretty strong about including insurance because you're going to have to be a consumer of that someday. A lot of that stuff can be taken and used in a business arena, like how to communicate with patients." "Students are interested," Schumerman said. "We're very fortunate that our numbers are remaining high every year. We tend to have pretty level numbers of kids that are still interested, especially for CNA. I think as more people are understanding what it means and what you can do with a certification, you can use it for other things besides nursing. I feel like it's become a little bit more popular as more people learn that." The program's Intro to Health Careers course typically averages 20 to 30 students, with smaller class sizes for upper level or more narrowly focused courses. The school's block scheduling allows the program to stand out from other local school-sponsored health, CTE, that stands for Career and Technical Education Programs, the teachers said. "Block scheduling makes it easier, in my opinion, to teach some of our classes," Roeder said. "When you're on a shorter time frame, like 8 classes, it makes it a little bit harder for students to do something large, like the anatomy and physiology dual credit, and get it all the information in." Also making Bettendorf's program unique, Schumertman added, it's targeted job shadow opportunities on mock interviews with local industry professionals. She said, we have kids that have been offered jobs from those mock interviews. Or employers will say, hey, if you pass your CNA, give me a call. For non-CNA or EMT students, Bettendorf's Health Science Program will work with local industry partners to offer the appropriate certification pathways to the best of their ability. Roeder said, right now I have a student who wants to be a veterinarian, so we're hoping to work with someone locally who will be able to help us out with that. Offering the program on-site is another benefit, especially for the students. Students might not have a car or additional money for gas, Roeder said, also noting teachers' access. We want to make sure it's accessible for everyone. Lopez pretty much knows she can come find us at any time without a problem. It would be so expensive to drive to EICC and come back for classes, Lopez added. Another highlight from the program, she added, has been getting to know and work with like-minded classmates. This has helped to develop patient communication and rapport skills. Sadega agreed, adding that small class sizes were also a plus. When I took medical terminology and CNA, which are both EICC classes, I think one of them had 8 kids in it and the other one had 6. You become a really tight-knit group. A lot of times you end up sticking with those people in other classes because you guys, meaning healthcare, is obviously something you're passionate about. For classes like medical terminology, which Lopez is like learning an entirely new language, peers typically help each other and the two students agree. The program also takes its fair of off-campus trips. Visiting the University of Iowa's Carver Medical College stood out for Zadega. That kind of gave me an idea of whether I wanted to become a nurse practitioner or a PA, physical assistant, she said. Overall, though, Zadega said clinicals have been her favorite part of the program. That was the most rewarding experience I've ever had in high school, she said. I think it teaches you so much about how to help other people and why you help other people, but it also teaches you a lot about yourself, too. Despite pursuing different areas in the health field care, both Zadega and Lopez feel better prepared moving forward, and both give a shout-out to their teachers, Schumertman and Doc Roeder. From the second you step foot into her class, she's talking about Schumertman, Schumertman will say, it's going to be hard. I'm going to push you. I have my golden standard, and you're going to meet my golden standard. Then you get into testing and clinicals, and all of a sudden you're like, this is really easy, Zadega said. They're also so supportive all around, whether it's personal, medical career advice, or just homework. They'll push you, and it's going to be the best experience you have ever had. Even for students who are not committed to a career in healthcare, Lopez recommends giving the program a try. Even if it's just a basic class, like an intro to health careers, she said, I learned how to suture someone, so if I'm ever in a situation where I'm cut or someone's cut and they need help, I might be able to help with that situation. Just having those basic life skills, like knowing how to respond under pressure and problem solving, is big. Jeff, back to you.
ADUs are closer to reality. This story from the Moline City Council. Moline Council is likely to pass an ordinance on shared lots. Moline is one approval away from establishing an ordinance for accessory dwelling units, which officials have been working on for more than a year. Council members passed the first of 2 approvals needed to establish the ordinance at the April 23rd meeting by a 6-2 vote. A final vote on the ordinance is likely to come before the council in May. Debbie Murphy, 1st Ward, and Anna Castro, 7th Ward, voted against the ordinance. Castro told the Dispatch Argus Quad City Times that she's not completely against ADUs, but residents of her ward brought multiple concerns to her attention regarding the proposed ordinance. She sees the value in ADUs, she said, with letting people family age in place, and for college kids, but could not vote for it based on concerns in her ward. Several residents in the 7th Ward opposed the ordinance, she said. I serve my ward by representing them. Murphy, who also voted no, did so because of constituents' concerns. A lot of residents in her ward, she said, were not in favor and expressed concerns with parking and the lack of space already available in the 1st Ward. Lots are smaller compared with other areas in Moline, Murphy said, and houses are already close enough to each other. An accessory dwelling unit, or ADU, is an additional living space on a single lot with an existing home. To meet the definition, such dwellings must be on the same lot as a single-family home and contain areas for sleeping, cooking, and bathing. Moline is not the first in the Quad Cities to consider an ADU ordinance. Rock Island, Bettendorf, and Davenport have ordinances pertaining to ADUs. Matt Timian of the 4th Ward told the Dispatch Argus and Quad City Times that ADUs already exist in Moline. Establishing an ordinance for ADUs, he said, allows the city to ensure that they are up to code and safe for those living in them. I think this is a step in the right direction for the city, Timian said. This is a smart addition to offer different housing types. This also is not the first time the council has been one step away from establishing an ADU ordinance. In February 2023, the then-council tried to pass an ordinance for ADUs without the Planning Commission's approval. At the time, the ordinance faced opposition from residents and the Planning Commission because of parking, inspection, and overall zoning concerns. There also was no rental housing licensing and inspection program. That program, passed in November 2023, aims to promote and protect the health, safety, and welfare of Moline renters. It's expected to go into effect sometime this spring. Alvaro Macias, 2nd Ward, and Timian reintroduced the ADU ordinance during a council informational session in December 2023. Macias said that not having a rental housing program was one of the reasons why the council did not pass the ADU ordinance last year. There have been a handful of people, he said, who've spoken out about thinking of building something like this for themselves or a family member to age in place. More than a year later, the Planning Commission unanimously approved recommending the current proposed ADU ordinance on Wednesday, April 10th. The commission recommended ordinance does not have additional parking requirements, states the dwellings cannot be used as vacation rentals, rented less than 30 days, and are subject to rental inspections unless occupied by a family member, and their design must relate to the principal structures. Chris Mathias, Community and Economic Development Director, said the dwellings could be attached, a coach house, detached, or interior. A coach house is defined in the proposed ordinance as above a garage. The property owner is required to reside in the single-family home or the dwelling unit, and only one ADU is allowed per property. Mathias said housing options in Moline had been decreasing for decades, and there is a lack of affordable housing. Accessory dwelling units, he said, are another option to address housing needs. ADUs offer the option for senior citizens to age in place and stay in close proximity to their family, Mathias said. And they do promote more dense development contrary to urban sprawl. Residents speak for and against. Three people spoke in favor of the ordinance during public comment at last week's council meeting. Josette McCoy said there was a real need for more housing and buying land was not always an option. An ADU, she said, will provide a unique way to add homes to neighborhoods rather than something like a multi-story apartment building that can offer space for a family or friend. I have a friend who has a young college student who's coming to the Quad Cities to do an internship and needs housing, McCoy said. As she thinks of herself and her husband, as they age, she said, they are not going to need a big house. If they want to build an ADU, she said, they would be able to downsize and rent out their house. Susanna Aguilar said if she ever had the chance to build onto her house, she would. An ADU would allow her mother to age in place with nearby support. She also mentioned how in a couple of years, she will have a college student, and whether she moves out or stays home, an ADU could provide privacy while she can still provide the resources her daughter would need. This one decision covers our seniors, our young adults, our children, she said. Craig Loken also spoke in favor on Thursday evening. He moved to Moline in 2021 and said they were able to have some older family move in with them. When a family member who was living with them was diagnosed with cancer, he said, they were able to provide any help they needed. At the Planning Commission's public hearing, Tim Miner said he has five children and his daughter recently moved back in because she was in a situation where work was not paying enough for her to afford where she was living. As a real estate agent, he also said he's seen numerous people priced out of buying homes. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem because we have to figure this out for future generations, Miner said. Deanne Moore was the only public commentator to speak against ADUs at last week's council meeting. Moore said she has concerns for what they could be used for based on how the ordinance was written. She said there was a chance someone could use it as a barbershop or some other type of commercial space. The ordinance only allows for ADUs in residential areas. The ordinance does allow for minor occupants or occupations since current code allows them in the main dwelling. Major home occupations are allowed only by obtaining a special use permit. Mathias said staff's thought process on the matter was if it was someone that was allowed in a home already, it should be considered okay for an ADU. Moore was also worried about parking and more cars taking up space. There are no parking requirements in the proposed ADU ordinance, but if someone is converting an existing detached or attached garage to an ADU, the required parking for the main house must be replaced on site, according to the proposed ordinance. Others who spoke against the ordinance at the Planning Commission's public hearing expressed concerns with parking, disrupting already established neighborhoods, lack of space, possible lack of maintenance, and enforcement. Barbara Sandberg expressed concern with the aesthetic and livability of neighborhoods. Given the close proximity of homes in the neighborhood she lives, she worries that if her neighbors were to build an ADU, it would be within feet of her property and infringe on her backyard. She also expressed worry that additional cars could also cause further congestion. Former Alderman Dick Potter said he was torn on the issue, acknowledging some ADUs already existed, but saying he was concerned with how the city would enforce rules and regulations pertaining to these properties. Potter said he was glad the council passed a rental housing inspection program, but would be more inclined to support the ADU ordinance if the inspection program was up and running. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. From the front page yesterday, pair were ready to shoot it out. Devon Brett allegedly said he wished Davenport police officers would have killed him during his January 18th arrest. Brett was arrested with Adriana Blake. Both were later charged with murder in the deaths of Brian L. Goodwin and Amy M. Smith, who were killed in the early morning hours of January 15th. Their bodies were discovered early January 16th after a neighbor reported a fire in the house he rented at 5210 North Division Street. Brett and Blake were in a relationship and were staying in Goodwin's house at the time of the deaths. A newly released search warrant requesting to download a cell phone's information detailed the hours leading up to the arrest of Brett and Blake in Davenport. From testimony at their preliminary hearing, it is clear investigators know Brett and Blake traveled to Galesburg, Illinois, sometime after the fire. It is believed that during the trip, Blake made a video about killing two people. By 4 p.m. January 18th, the person referred to in the search warrant as a witness told Davenport police Brett and Blake were in a motor vehicle in the Quad City area. The witness said the vehicle broke down in the cold and snow, and they asked the witness for another vehicle. Davenport police then used the witness to set up a meeting with Blake and Brett at the Quick Star on 100 West 6th Street. According to search warrants, the witness continued to exchange texts with Blake. At roughly 8 p.m., Blake told the witness that she and Brett had multiple firearms. A half hour later, during a recorded phone call, Blake said she and Brett had two firearms and were ready to, quote, shoot it out with the police. During the phone conversation, Blake said Brett had a 9, which is the common term for a 9mm handgun. She also said, according to the search warrant, that the gun used in the homicide was still in their possessions. Fateful meetings. Brett and Blake arrived at the Quick Star at 11:50 p.m. January 18th in a white Ford Explorer driven by a third person who has not been charged. According to the report, Brett did have a 9mm Glock handgun on him. It was after his arrest that Brett allegedly told police officers that he wished they had killed him. Investigators and Scott County Attorney Kelly Cunningham have not publicly offered a motive for the murders of Goodwin and Smith. Blake and Brett have appeared as co-defendants in their court appearances. Blake has written 3 letters to Judge Michael Motto to complain about various aspects of her incarceration in the Scott County Jail. Brett was held for a time in the Muscatine County Jail, but has returned to the Scott County Jail. He also faces federal charges for violating the terms of his parole. Both Blake and Brett removed their ankle monitors in the days leading up to the homicides, court documents state. Jeff?
Child psychologist travels to Egypt. A yearning to give back to his home community sent a Genesis child psychologist to Egypt last month. Dr. Ahmed El-Madawi is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Genesis Health System in Davenport. He's been with the hospital for about 2 years, but has spent the majority of his career working in the Midwest. Originally from Egypt, El-Madawi made the trip to Africa in March to lend his services to the people and refugees in his home region. Egypt neighbors Gaza, where a violent war has been waging for several months. Since I'm a child psychiatrist by training, I've tried to help improve the mental health in the area where I grew up, he said. El-Madawi described the geographic area as being similar to the border between the United States and Canada. With the war becoming increasingly violent and the need for all services ever present, he decided to volunteer. I've been having a collaboration with many of the Middle Eastern countries before. I was in Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and Egypt, of course, he said. This time, El-Madawi was not in any war zones. His work was mainly in Cairo, Egypt's capital, where it was safest for him to be. Most of the people who are really in need are from refugee camps. A lot of patients who may not be fortunate enough to have good mental health services end up being in need of that, he said. For a long time, I was working with the Egyptian government, and I was able to provide some volunteer work to those patients who were in underserved areas. The war is essentially knocking on Egypt's door, he said, and praised the doctor. He praised the doctors and decided, or who decided, to go into the war zone and help. Psychiatry, he said, is the treatment that follows physical care, and played a big role in what he wanted to volunteer. I have no ways to predict how someone will be traumatized, he said. That's why the role of mental health is to bring support, if you can, in the area of the disaster. El-Madawi saw patients from all across the Middle East, Palestinians, Yemenis, Jordanians, and Egyptians alike. Their cases ranged from teenagers having trouble in school to children exposed to trauma, abuse, and the anxieties that come with living in a war-torn region. Attitudes around mental health care in the United States have changed drastically since COVID, he said. The same attitude is also more accepted worldwide, especially in younger children who are exposed to new stresses and different environments. Virtual sessions also have opened doors, he said. Many families in the Middle East may not have access to basic services, but being able to be on a Zoom call or speak with a professional assists families in being more understanding and proactive, a massive change from a few years ago, he said. When he was working in Cairo, the big advantage El-Madawi noticed was that he not only knew the culture, but could speak the language. Back in the days when I was growing up, I remember it was very difficult, especially in our field, for patients to talk and express their emotions in a different language, he said. Expressing emotions like anxiety, depression, fears, and concerns are difficult for anyone, and more so when the patient has to say them in a language not comfortable to them, he said, especially given the political climate and culture in the Middle East right now. El-Madawi said he has been back to Egypt several times since moving away, but noticed in March the country was rationing its resources. The power was shut down a few times to conserve energy, and water was limited. He noticed people were even more cautious with their budgets, and the country tried its best to provide help at the border. Even the United Nations collected donations to drive up there, he said. Conflict in the Middle East has been going on so long, some people are becoming used to it, he said. The difference with this war is the constant bombings and threat to their lives, which has amped up concerns for everyone. There are a lot of movements and everyone is aware. Everyone wakes up reading the news, he said. It's really heartbreaking and people are more vigilant now. The need for mental health services, especially for children, is crucial right now, El-Madawi said. His cultural connection directly relates to his desire to help. It's almost a responsibility I have, he said. I feel more grounded. I feel like I can appreciate more where I come from.
And now it's about time to go to the obituaries. Today there are 5 obituaries. And it starts out with 3 funerals that are pending. So I will begin with the funerals. The first is for Thomas E. Bivens, 74, of Taylor Ridge, who passed away Friday, April 26, 2024, at Unity Point Health Trinity, Rock Island. Arrangements at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. And again, that was for Thomas E. Blivens, 74, of Taylor Ridge. The next funeral pending is for Barbara Ford, 75, of Rock Island, who passed away April 27, 2024, in Rock Island. Arrangements are pending at Sullivan Ellis LTD in East Moline. And the final is for Judy A. Mayer, 78th of Rock Island, who passed away Friday, April 26, 2024, at Unity Point Health, Trinity, Rock Island. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Jack?
Ramona M. Tates, age 94, of Geneseo, passed away on Thursday, April 25th, at her home. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, May 1st, at St. Malachy Catholic Church in Geneseo. Father Donald Levitt will officiate. Cremation rites will be accorded following the Mass, and a private interment will be held at Oakwood Cemetery, Geneseo. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th, at Vandemore Funeral Homes and Cremation, Geneseo Chapel. A recitation of the Rosary will be held at 4:30 p.m. prior to the visitation at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the Ramona Tates Memorial Fund. Ramona was born June 16, 1929, the daughter of John and Lucien Delon Vandesample of Rock Island. She graduated from Rock Island High School, class of 1947. On September 13, 1952, Ramona married Paul R. Tates at a service held in Rock Island. He preceded her in death on December 31, 2015. Ramona was a member of the St. Malachy Catholic Church and served on the Altar and Rosary Society. She was also in the Country Estates Quilting Club. Her hobbies included bowling, golf, making ceramics, and quilting. She loved spending time with her family and will be dearly missed. Those left to cherish her memory include her children, Michael, wife Sherry Tates of Coal Valley, Barbara Miller of Osco, and Elizabeth and husband Jeff Wagner of German Valley, Illinois. 15 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, with one on the way, and sister Yvonne Worthman of Davenport. She was preceded in death by her parents, John and Lucienne Vandesample, sons Camille Mel Tates and Donald Tates Jr., siblings John Vandesample, Daniel Vandesample, Jackie Neff, and son-in-law, Dwayne Miller.
Robert Bransell Martin, 90, of Ames, Iowa, formerly of Davenport, died February 14, 2024, at North Crest Retirement Community in Ames. His memorial service will be Saturday, May 4, 2024, at Wirtz Funeral Home in Davenport. Visitation begins at 12:30 p.m. and the service at 2 p.m. Memorials may be made to the North Crest Community Foundation, St. John's United Methodist Church, or Oakdale Memorial Gardens Oak Tree Fund. Robert, known as Bob, was born November 29, 1933, at Mercy Hospital in Davenport to William E. and Carmela Bransell Martin. He married Mona Cadell of Tyler Ridge, Illinois, on April 7, 1956, and they spent nearly 68 happy years together. Bob graduated from Davenport High School with the class of 1952. In 1955, Bob founded his masonry business, the Robert Martin Company, building and designing masonry structures throughout the Quad Cities. In 1967, Bob purchased several acres of land where he constructed and leased commercial and industrial buildings and manufactured pre-stressed concrete and floor systems. In the 1970s, he became a field representative for J.A. Nearing Company. Bob had eclectic hobbies, and he had an early fascination for ornithology. Survivors include his wife, Mona, his brother, William, and spouse, Julie Martin, William and Julie Martin of LeClaire, a daughter, Beth, and husband, Peter Martin of Ames, son, Charles, and wife, Heather Martin of Davenport, grandchildren, Nora and husband, Andrew Peterson of Lincoln, Nebraska, Kai and Ann Martin of Oregon, Wisconsin, and Glenn and Bushiel Martin of Bemidji, Minnesota, and five great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents and sister Mary Daly and brother Michael Martin. Burial will be in Oaksdale Memorial Gardens in Davenport.
Nona Frances Johnson, age 92, passed away to be with her Lord on April 19th. A visitation will be held on Saturday, May 4th at Ankeny Christian Church in Ankeny from 10 o'clock to 11 a.m. A service will follow the visitation. Burial will take place at the Iowa Masonic Cemetery in Des Moines. Ling's Blossom Care Center hosts a quarterly memorial service for residents who've recently passed. Frances will be included in the service being held at their chapel at 1415 Almond Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota on May 16th at 4 p.m. Frances was born to John McCollum and Ora Cruz McCollum on May 31st, 1931 in Steele, Missouri. She attended Steele High School, where she graduated salutatorian in 1949. Frances also attended college classes in Columbus, Georgia. Frances was devoted to her husband Sam and her family. She stayed home to raise her three children until they reached school age. She then resumed her career as an office administrator and manager, first at Graham Equipment and later at Commercial Printing in Des Moines. She then worked at Oak Helm Partners Real Estate after she and Sam moved to Davenport. Frances always said there was never a day when she didn't enjoy going to work. Frances was a faithful member of Union Park United Methodist Church in Des Moines, St. John's United Methodist Church in Davenport, and most recently, Ankeny Christian Church. After moving to St. Paul, Minnesota in 2022, she attended services at Ling Blonstein Care Center Chapel. Frances was preceded in death by her husband of 66 years, Sam Edward Johnson, her parents, and three brothers. Frances is survived by her children, Kathy Johnson, Teresa, and husband Philip Vetter, and William Craig and spouse Gail Johnson, and grandchildren Marissa and with Tom Ernest Yetter, Kevin Yetter, and Jordan, spouse Graham Richards. The family would like to express their gratitude to the staff at Ling Blonstein Care Center and to the caregivers from Wesley Life in Des Moines, visiting angels in St. Paul for their dedicated and loving service over the past 2 years. In lieu of flowers, Frances' family suggests memorial contributions for the Ankeny Christian Church, the Alzheimer's Association, or Ling Blonstein Foundation, Incorporated. Carol?
Dr. Patrick T. O'Brien, DDS, of Bacchus, Minnesota, died on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, at St. Joseph's Hospital in Brainerd, Minnesota, following a long-term illness. A celebration of life service will be held at Bettendorf Presbyterian Church in Bettendorf, Iowa, on Sunday, July 14th, 2024, at 1 p.m., with Reverend Troy Winder officiating. A luncheon with story sharing will follow the service at the same location. Patrick was born to Merle Jerome and Betty J. Mears O'Brien in Newton, Iowa, on November 9, 1941. He grew up in Newton, graduating from Newton High School in the class of 1959. After high school, he attended the University of Iowa, graduating with a BA degree in 1963. Continuing his education, he earned a Doctor of Dental Surgery from the College of Dentistry in the University of Iowa in 1967. He married his wife, Carol O'Brien, Jersa, on June 24th, 1967. He ran his dental practice until his retirement in 1998 and was an adjunct professor from 78 through 2002 at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. Patrick was survived by his wife of almost 57 years, Carol, son Patrick O'Brien, and wife Kathleen of Long Grove, Iowa, daughter Erin Christine O'Brien of Plymouth, Minnesota, daughter Reverend Catherine O'Brien Saltow, and husband Jeffrey of Maple Grove, Minnesota, sisters Barbara Ann Mihalovich and husband Daniel of Tucson, Arizona, Mary Kathleen Rooney of Tucson, Arizona, and his grandchildren and many nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, the family kindly requests donations to be made to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital.
Susan Holtz, 67, of East Moline, passed away Thursday, April 25th, at St. Anthony's Rehabilitation and Nursing Center. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, May 2nd, at Davenport Memorial Park. Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island will be assisting the family. Susan was born July 25th, 1956, in Davenport, the daughter of Ernest and Joan Martin Holtz. She loved crocheting, cooking, and reading her Bible. Those left to cherish her memory are her father and brother, David Holtz. She was preceded in death by her mother. Condolences may be left at WhelanPresley.com.
That was the final opinion, the final obituary for today. So we'll move over to the opinion page. And the top half of this page is covered with a drawing of Trump holding a Bible and giving a thumbs up. The title for these two articles is Selling the Scriptures, and the first part is what I will read. Former President Perverts the Word of God. Former President Donald Trump began hawking a God Bless the USA Bible in March for $59.99. It's a King James version that also includes the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's make America pray again, he said. We must defend God in the public square and not allow the media or the left-wing groups to silence, censor, or discriminate against us. We have to bring Christianity back into our lives and back into what will again be a great nation. It makes you wonder if the former president knows anything about the history of religion in this nation. Does he not understand that the Founding Fathers demanded the freedom of each person to determine their own religious affiliation? And that the government should have no role in determining a person's beliefs? The Founding Fathers wanted to make sure this nation did not fall into the religious warfare and bloodshed that ravaged Europe for many centuries. This nation was founded on the belief that people could make their own decisions about God. We have not always been perfect in pursuing this principle, but we've been trying to live up to it since the nation's founding. What Trump and his followers are proclaiming is not Christianity, a devotion to following Jesus and his teachings. Instead, they push Christian nationalism, something that surely makes God shake God's head in disbelief. Excuse me. Demanding that every decision by the government be made according to their interpretation of the scriptures is not only a violation of those scriptures, it also violates the Constitution's First Amendment, which declares that, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, unquote. The First Amendment was written to protect people from the tyranny of all religions. Those who proclaim this is a Christian nation do not understand either history or the scriptures. Christian nationalism is nothing less than a willful misreading of the scriptures. According to the very Bible that Trump is hawking, God has an overwhelming preference for the poor, the orphaned, the widowed, and the stranger in our midst. The Bible declares we're to live together in harmony and peace. The Bible is based on love for all people and for all of creation. The Bible holds that we are all created in the very image of God. Christian nationalism is based on hatred and white supremacy. It is about us versus them and declares that some are better than others. Christianity is not a national religion, and Christian nationalism has no business running this country. It's a perversion of God's love, mercy, justice, and everlasting love. I am an Episcopal priest who strives to align my beliefs and life with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I fall short all too often, but I do my best to follow Jesus. What I do not do is demand that everyone else believe as I do. Christian nationalism claims the laws of this land are determined by so-called Christian principles, but it fails to recognize that those principles are in direct violation of what the Bible actually says. If Trump and his followers wanted Christian values to run this country, they would ensure everyone had enough to eat and clean water to drink. They would demand health care for all. They would welcome immigrants and asylum seekers. They would grant women full reproductive rights and control over their own bodies and futures. They would empty the prisons, proclaim jubilee, and forgive debts. They would make this nation the shining light on a hill that President Ronald Reagan proclaimed it was, although he too failed to follow through. If we were to follow God's laws and desires in this nation, we would all have more than enough. We would celebrate every single person, and we would realize that perverting God's word to make political decisions and gains is nothing less than sin. And this was written by the Reverend Lauren R. Stanley, who is an Episcopal priest in the Diocese of South Dakota. Jeff, back to you.
The accompanying opinion piece is entitled, Trump is Right to Make America Godly Again. It's written by Reverend Stephen Lewis Kraft, who is a professional prison chaplain and facilitator with Prison Fellowship Ministries. He's a member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Network. He writes, Trump is right to make America godly again. Former President Donald Trump was recently accused of Bible blasphemy for selling a version of the Bible. Is this truly blasphemy, or is it a way to encourage his followers to study the Holy Scriptures to make America great and godly again? In the court of law, the evidence would demand a verdict, so let the evidence speak for itself. I will present my case for the defense of Trump. The first witness for the defense is the Bible itself. When the devil tried to tempt Jesus Christ with the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life in Matthew 4, 1-11, Jesus responded with the scripture. The second witness for the defense is the testimony of the founding fathers of our nation, George Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson, who spoke of the importance of God in our nation's original documents. The third witness for the defense is President Ronald Reagan, who designated in 1983 as the year of the Bible. Reagan also was falsely accused of violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which prohibits the government from favoring one religion over others. His enemies ignored the Free Exercise Clause, which allows Americans to practice their religion as they please. The fourth witness for the defense are the millions of Bible-believing Christians throughout America who understand the motivating factor in which Trump is following in the footsteps of Christ and the Founding Fathers. Make America great again is important if we make America godly again. This is the true meaning of the MAGA vision. Before the 1960s, most Americans believed the birth of our nation was a work of God through the Bible. God Bless the USA was our song, and we believed we were born to be a city set on a hill and a light to the world. As a result of such biblical beliefs, we knew that no matter how difficult times may be, God would see us through and cause us to prosper. We believe and cause excuse me. We believed that when we joined together in sincere prayer, seeking wisdom, comfort, and guidance from God through the Holy Bible, we would draw spiritual strength to deal with difficult situations. That's what 2 Chronicles 7:14 tells us. This spiritual response to national crisis in American tradition is an American tradition that goes back to before the Revolutionary War. Faith in God and a conscience based on that faith and found in the Bible was the motivating factor in the hearts of many Americans during such times. This flowed out of a sense of reverence for God in people's hearts. But these blessings cannot be sustained when the Christian church remains silent in the face of rampant immorality and wickedness. God is warning us in the Bible that rebellion and immorality will ultimately destroy us if we don't return to the truth taught in Scripture. I believe this is the defense in promoting a return to studying and obeying the Word of God. Even though Trump is not a perfect man, he does have every right and indeed obligation as a Christian to encourage people to turn back to God again. So I submit to all those who love our nation that this court, based on the evidence, acquits Trump of the charge of Bible blasphemy. Back to you, Carol.
Turning to the sports page, Midwest League, Quad Cities, 8, South Bend 2. Walks helped the Bandits win 4th straight series. A late offensive explosion helped the Quad Cities River Bandits walk their way to an 8-2 victory over the hosting South Bend Cubs Sunday afternoon at the Four Winds Field. The River Bandits scored 7 runs in the 6th and 7th innings to keep the offense rolling after Saturday's 12-7 victory. Sunday's win gave Quad Cities 4 wins in the 6-game set. Quad Cities drew 11 of the game's 18 walks that were issued as it won its 4th straight series to open the Class A Midwest League campaign. Jack Pineda delivered 3 of Quad Cities' 9 hits and drove in 3 runs for the 15-6 River Bandits as they dropped South Bend to 6-15. The game was knotted at 1 through 5 innings as Quad Cities starting pitcher Shane Panzini and South Bend starter Tyler Schlaefer both left after 4 innings of work, leaving the outcome to the bullpens. Quad Cities got much better work out of its relievers as Cooper McKeon Cooper McKeon, A.J. Block, Nathaniel Garabitos, and Brandon Johnson held the Cubbies to 2 hits and 1 earned run in the final 5 innings. South Bend scored off Garabitos in the 8th after Quad Cities' offense had taken control. After McKeon worked around 2 walks to start his innings of work in the 5th, Quad City took advantage of 3 walks and a hit batter to help blow open the game in the 6th. Jared Dickey led off the 6th with a solo homer to give Quad Cities a lead it never lost. With 1 out, Justin Johnson was hit by a pitch, and Gene Ramirez singled. Carson Rocforte, Pineda, and Carter Jensen all drew walks to push across 2 runs. After a pitching change, Rocforte scored on a balk. In the 7th, Pineda delivered a 2-run single that scored Johnson, RBI double that scored Dustin Dickerson, who reached on a walk, and Rocforte a walk. After an off day on Monday, the River Bandits opened a 6-day game set at Beloit against the 11 wins and 9 losses Skycarp, who were rained out in Cedar Rapids on Sunday. Jeff?
Back to basketball. Clark and the Fever open training camp. Caitlin Clark got back to basics Sunday, working out on a basketball court. Here is the newest member of the Indiana Fever. She's learning how she'll fit into this new offensive system, building chemistry with her new teammates, and learning the nuances of what it means to be the WNBA's highest profile rookie. Sure, Clark anticipates some bumps this season. She wouldn't expect anything less. But giving the sport she loves her full attention is really all Clark ever wanted. I think that's what I most was excited about, getting all that other stuff out of the way, the former Iowa star said in Indiana's training camp. The draft was amazing. New York City was amazing. Los Angeles was amazing. But I was excited to get here and get back to playing basketball. You know, doing my job. Over the past two seasons, those WNBA rookies have created the kind of buzz around women's basketball most fans only dreamed about. And Clark is indisputably the head of the class. Ticket sales increased at every venue she appeared, and when Clark's games were televised, ratings spiked. Her chase of the Division I career scoring record captivated basketball fans across America, and she even appeared on Saturday Night Live. Well, that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.